This is Bill Munhausen with another edition of What Makes Sense, and reviewing the fifth week of Biblical Citizenship, maybe even the sixth week. The subtitle of week five is Who Has Authority? A limited government is not one that is small in size. It is one that recognizes jurisdictional lines to understand what belongs to government and what does not. Such a government can be small or large. Certainly for a country of 300 million people, it must be rather large. However, government has a role and it mustn't intrude where individuals have authority. David Barton gave us several quick examples of jurisdictional boundaries. Marriage is part of the moral law. Therefore, God is the one who defines it. Government should never cross that jurisdictional line and change it to be something else. Barton was probably thinking in terms of government redefining marriage to include same-sex relationships, but there's more to it than that. Why should government care who's married anyway? Why should there be marriage licenses? My mind immediately goes to taxes. Many years ago, when men were the primary breadwinners and government was formulating the tax code, they perceived single men having an advantage because it was cheaper to support one person compared to two. To make taxes more fair, they allowed married men to have additional deductions for wife and children. Government also had an interest in promoting marriage because married couples produce children, and children are necessary for the continuation of the nation. Marriage rules were woven into the tax code, insurance coverage, and all sorts of unexpected places. Fast forward to the present, and all seems ill-advised in a world where most women have jobs outside the home, and same-sex couples enjoy the same benefits as heterosexual couples, even though they produce no children. All of the marriage rules seem out of place, and it's all because government intruded where they didn't belong. Inasmuch as government shouldn't interfere in marriage, government has jurisdiction to promote and support marriage as both a stabilizing institution in society and the only source of future citizens. However, since marriage is in God's jurisdiction, government can only rightfully promote marriage in the form defined by God. The Supreme Court ruled in Grigsby v. Reed in 1913, and the majority argument was well stated. Marriage was not originated by human law. When God created Eve, she was a wife to Adam. They then and there occupied the status of husband to wife and wife to husband. The truth is that civil government has grown out of marriage, which created homes and population and society, from which government became necessary. Marriages will produce a home and family that will continue or contribute to good society, to free and just government, and the support of Christianity. It would be sacrilegious to apply the designation a civil contract to such a marriage. It is that and more. It is a status ordained by God. Quite amazing how the Supreme Court once said such godly things. The Founding Fathers said that the General Welfare Clause was not to be interpreted as saying an industry was too big to fail and needs a bailout. During the debates concerning bailing out the codfish industry in 1791, James Madison wrote, "If Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare, and are the sole and supreme judge of the general welfare, they may take the care of religion into their own hands. They may appoint teachers in every state, county, and parish, and pay them out of their public treasury. They may take into their own hands the education of children, establishing in like manner schools throughout the Union. They may assume the provision of the poor. They may undertake the regulation of all roads other than post roads. In short, everything from the highest object of state legislation down to the most minute object of police would be thrown under the power of Congress." Were the power of Congress to be established in the latitude contended for, it would subvert the very foundations and transmute the very nature of the limited government established by the people of America. The Patriot Academy authors of biblical citizenship include Madison's quote both for its irony and its application to modern America. Whereas it was almost unthinkable in Madison's day, government has indeed taken over so many activities, like schooling and charity and road maintenance, that were really the concerns of local communities. They manage these things from far away and manage them unfairly because they lack the local government perspective to understand community issues. But it's all done in the name of general welfare. Article 1, Sections 8 through 10 of the Constitution contain provisions that clarify jurisdictions. Section 8 contains dues for the federal government, such as the power to tax and to coin money. Section 9 of the Constitution contains don'ts for the federal government. For example, the federal government may not tax trade between states. Section 10 contains don'ts for the states, such as forbidding treaties with foreign countries. It was important to the framers of the Constitution to prevent different governing authorities from stepping on each other's toes. Clear jurisdiction prevented conflict. Furthermore, the Constitution is designed to maintain jurisdictions. Congress cannot add power to itself. It only comes from us. The only way Congress can gain additional powers is if it is approved through the amendment process approved by the people of each state. In an earlier segment, we talked about prohibition. The people had to pass a constitutional amendment to prohibit the consumption of alcohol. When that plan turned out badly, they had to approve a new amendment to reverse the other one. Congress couldn't just pass laws because they didn't have the authority under the Constitution. This session then went on a little rabbit trail regarding taxation and debt. Congress has the power to collect taxes to pay debts and to provide for the future common defense and general welfare of the United States. Debt was a serious concern among the founders because borrowing money was considered something like a moral failure. Responsible people didn't spend money they didn't have, and leaving the debt for a future generation was seen as theft against that generation. A great deal of our political arguing in this day stems from the perception of debt, which ultimately goes back to spending. Alexander Hamilton said that the test for spending money constitutionally is whether it is for a general purpose or a local purpose. He wrote, "Consider for a moment the immeasurable difference between the Constitution, limited in its powers to the enumerated objects, and expounding as it would be by the import claimed for the phraseology in question. The difference is equivalent to two constitutions, of characters essentially contrasted with each other, the one possessing power confined to certain specific cases, the other extended to all cases whatsoever. Can less be said than that it is impossible that such a constitution as the latter would have been recommended to the states by all the members of the body whose names were subscribed in the instrument? Is it credible that such a power would have been unnoticed and unopposed in the federal convention? In the state conventions, which contended for and proposed restrictive and explanatory statements, and in the Congress of 1789, which recommended so many of these amendments, a power to impose unlimited taxes for unlimited purposes could never have escaped those public bodies." To Hamilton's way of thinking, no government body would ever approve the Constitution if it offered no limits to the scope of government. It was unthinkable. But that was before America became so rich and powerful that money was no longer a limiting factor restraining politicians from doing whatever action they might imagine. James Madison wrote, "The Constitution is a limited one, possessing no power not actually given, and carrying on the face of it a distrust of power beyond the distrust indicated by the ordinary forms of free government. The United States came very close to a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution in 1999, failing by just one vote. Another greatly abused power of the federal government is to regulate commerce. Where modern legislators see regulation as control or management, the meaning when the Constitution was crafted was something more like keeping regular. Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations, between the several states, and with the Indian nations. Since the states under the Articles of Confederation and the Indian nations were essentially separate nations, keeping trade regular and free was an important responsibility of the federal government. This was not a license to micromanage the market. Thomas Jefferson said that the pillars of our prosperity are the most thriving when left most free to individual enterprise. The founders were specific about everything in the Constitution because they had a real distrust of power. Our system has separation of powers between the levels of government as well as the branches. Constitution signer John Dickinson said, "Nothing is more certain than that the forms of liberty may be retained when the substance is gone. In government as well as in religion, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life." In order to understand the words of the Constitution, you have to understand the spirit in which it was written. It's important to follow the spirit of the General Welfare Clause and the rest of the Constitution, rather than trying to squeeze a new meaning out of the wording. John Witherspoon said, "Shall we establish nothing good because we know it cannot be eternal? Shall we live without government because every constitution has its old age and its period? Because we know that we shall die, shall we take no pains to preserve or lengthen our life? Far from it. It only requires the more watchful attention to settle government upon the best principles and in the wisest manner, that it may last as long as the nature of things will permit." It's also important for us to remember that the founders of our nation believed deeply in their duty to God. Samuel Adams stated that the man who conscientiously does his duty will be protected by God and receive an ample reward. First Supreme Court Justice John Jay wrote, "All that the best men can do is to persevere in doing their duty to their country and leave the consequences to him who made it their duty. Being neither elated by success, however great, nor discouraged by disappointment, however frequent and mortifying, we must go home to be happy, and our home is not in this world. Here we have nothing to do but our duty, and by it to regulate our business and our pleasures." A final note about duty. Currently, in city and school board elections, only 3% to 6% of America show up to vote. Nations get healthy from the bottom up, not the top down. And certainly, the responsibility or the duty of citizens to vote is one of the most fundamental things we can perform. That brings us to Lesson 6 in the Biblical Citizenship series, subtitled Of Kings and Courts. It's about the presidency and the judiciary. In an Election Day sermon delivered to the new Connecticut government by Reverend Matthias Burnett, he said, "To God and posterity, you are accountable for your rights and your rulers. Let not your children have reason to curse you for giving up those rights and prostrating those institutions which our fathers delivered to you as a sacred palladium, and which by the blessing of God have been peculiarly beneficial to the order, peace, and prosperity of this state." In that spirit, we recognize the most significant part of the president's responsibilities is to make sure the laws are faithfully executed. His job is to execute the laws created by Congress. John Adams said that faithfully executing the laws would make us a nation of laws and not of men. The interest of the people is one thing. It is the public interest. And where the public interest governs, it is a government of laws and not men. The interest of a king or a party is another thing. It's a private interest. And where private interest governs, it is a nation of men and not of laws. In public officials, we should look for people who will set themselves aside and enforce the will of the people. This philosophy stands in sharp contrast to our modern experience, where Americans only seem to care about presidential elections, where they will vote for that one special person who will rule the nation. It reminds me of what God said to the people of Israel when they demanded a king so that they could be like other nations. 1 Samuel 8:4 through 18 reads, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel, and they said to him, 'Behold, you've grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint us a king to judge us as like all the other nations.' But the matter was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, 'Listen to the voice of the people regarding all that they say to you, because they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have abandoned me and served other gods, so they are doing to you as well. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall warn them strongly and tell them of the practice of the king who will reign over them.' So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him for a king, and he said, 'This will be the practice of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and put them in his chariots for himself and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to gather in his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters and use them as perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your seed and your vineyards and give it to his high officials and his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants, and your best young men and your donkeys, and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out on that day because of your king, whom you've chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you on that day. The picture is one of kings and his cohorts as a ruling elite, not so unlike what our nation has become." The president, more than any other entity, is the one who decides whether we are a government of laws or a government of men. A president can decide to rule unilaterally, or he can dissolve some of the executive department and streamline the presidency to conform to its constitutional role. The part we can play is to not take him or her so seriously that they might take themselves less seriously. Another part we can play is to defend key portions of the constitutional design, such as the Electoral College. The Electoral College is a way for the people and the states to have a voice in the election of the president. The founders rejected having the president elected by popular vote because the most populated areas would outvote the more rural states, and every region of the country must have a say. The founding fathers used the Electoral College to strike a balance that would require the winner to have both a sufficient vote of the people and a sufficient distribution of the vote in every region. In a popular vote scenario, the major deciders for the presidency would be the big cities. The founders didn't have a high opinion of cities. Thomas Jefferson wrote in a letter to Benjamin Rush, "I view great cities as pestilential to the morals, the health, and the liberties of man." Rush replied, "I agree with you in your opinion of cities." Cowper the poet very happily expresses our idea of them compared with the country. "God made the country, man made cities. I consider them in the same light that I do abscesses on the human body, as reservoirs of all the impurities of a community." Supporters of national popular vote want pure democracy rather than a constitutional republic. John Witherspoon wrote, "Pure democracy cannot subsist long, nor be carried far into the departments of state. It is very subject to caprice and the madness of popular rage." John Adams wrote about democracy, saying, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." Benjamin Rush opined, "A simple democracy is one of the greatest of evils. A democracy is a mobocracy." Here are a few random but relevant examples of how citizens have tried to perfect the presidency. Section 3 of the 25th Amendment is the process by which the president declares he or she unable to fulfill the duties of the presidency. Section 4 of the 25th Amendment is the process by which the VP and a majority of the cabinet declare the president unable to fulfill the duties of the presidency. When has the 25th Amendment been invoked under Section 4? Only in the movies. This is a case where a provision in a constitutional amendment went through the entire process, even though there never was an actual need for it. But to be fair, Section 3 was used once by President Ronald Reagan and twice by President George Bush. I guess the fourth section was added to the 25th Amendment just in case the situation arose. Another topic is executive orders. Do only really bad presidents use them? The practice of issuing executive orders actually started with President Washington, and he wasn't being a tyrant. Executive orders are practical and constitutional as long as they are executing a law that Congress has actually passed. A good example is immigration. Congress has constitutional authority to establish immigration laws. A president may issue an executive order to emphasize a portion of that law, but he or she may not, or should not, issue an executive order to avoid enforcing the law. Many attempts have been made to keep leaders accountable as oaths of office. The founders believed that the foundation of oaths was in being more afraid of God than following the oath. Fear of the God before whom you swore was the real impetus for keeping the oath. That means nothing when non-believers are in office. The 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution, written by Benjamin Franklin, barred anyone from holding office unless they believed in a future state of rewards and punishment. Could that oath be applied in a nation that has rejected God? Constitution signer Roger Sherman wrote, "If the president alone was vested with the power of appointing all officers and was left to select a council for himself, he would be liable to be deceived by flatterers and pretenders to patriotism, who would have no motive but their own emolument," meaning self-seeking profit and gain. This is why we must constantly rein in the power of the presidency. Let's move on to the judiciary, the weakest branch of government. If you believe in evolution as a philosophy of life, it permeates every area, including your view of the Constitution. Today, the law schools teach that judges are responsible for all law. Law schools don't teach truth as it exists. They teach truth as they want it to be, or what they imagine it to be, which leaves them in charge of what happens to the Constitution. Of the 27 grievances in the Declaration of Independence, 4 of them were regarding judges. The founders wanted to avoid lifetime appointments for judges because they distrusted the power a judge might accumulate over a lifetime. The judicial branch has taken control they were never designed to have because we, the people, have not known the Constitution ourselves. Samuel Adams complained about judicial tyranny in the form of lack of accountability and lifetime appointments as far back as 1765. One of the myths regarding the Constitution is that the three branches are co-equal. The Federalist Papers were written by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison, and are like an instruction manual for the Constitution. In Federalist Paper No. 51, Madison said the legislative branch necessarily predominates because it is the branch that is to the people. In Federalist Paper No. 78, Hamilton said the judiciary was the weakest branch and would not be a threat to our liberty if it remained in its proper jurisdiction. Hamilton wrote, "The judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power. The general liberty of the people can never be endangered from this quarter. I mean, so long as the judiciary remains truly distinct from both the legislature and the executive." And it proves, in the last place, that as liberty can have nothing to fear from the judiciary alone, but would have everything to fear from its union with either of the other departments, the judiciary has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction either of the strength or of the wealth of society, and can take no active resolution whatever. It may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment, and must ultimately depend upon the aid of the executive arm, even for the efficacy of its judgments. Hamilton added, the judiciary was established by and is accountable to the other two branches of government because they owe a responsibility to the people. William Giles described how dependent the Supreme Court is on the authority of Congress. Superficial observers take it for granted that the three departments of government are coordinate and independent upon each other. It is to be observed that the words coordinate and independent are not to be found in any part of the Constitution. According to the Constitution, the establishment of the Judiciary Department was entrusted to the Legislative Department. Is the Judiciary Department formed by the Constitution? It is not. It is only declared that there shall be such a department, and it is directed to be formed by the other two departments, who owe a responsibility to the people. The number of judges, the affirmation of duties, the fixing of compensations, fixing the times when and the places where the courts shall exercise the functions, are left to the entire discretion of Congress. Congress may postpone the sessions of the courts for 8 to 10 years, and establish others to whom they could transfer all the powers of the existing courts. The spirit, as well as the words of the Constitution, are completely satisfied, provided one Supreme Court be established. The power of the Supreme Court to override the will of the people is based almost entirely on custom and past practices rather than the actual authority given in the Constitution. The Constitution leaves it entirely to the discretion of Congress as to how many members will be on the court, how many lower courts to be established from time to time. Congress may also set the agenda, removing issues from the purview of the court. A second myth regarding the judiciary is that federal judges have lifetime appointments. Judges are not appointed for life. They continue subject to good behavior. Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution says, quote, "The judges both of the supreme and inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior," end quote. Judges have been impeached for issuing an order contradicting an act of Congress, drunkenness in private life, rudeness in the courtroom, profanity, and judicial high-handedness. According to James Wilson, here in the United States, the people are masters of government. Elsewhere, the government is masters of the people. It is the unique characteristic of our form of government that we need to preserve.
Thanks for joining us today. Until next time, go out and do good.